This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Pretty Mess by Erica Jane with Brian Moylan. Read by Erica Jane.
Chapter 1. Eve Harrington from the Start. I made my stage debut at 5. I was in the St. John the Baptist kindergarten production of Mrs. Jingleby. It was a Christmas pageant with singing that sounded more like screaming in unison. The dancing looked like a bunch of drunk bunny rabbits trying to find their way home after a bender. I don't exactly remember the plot of the show. I was cast as an elf, essentially relegating me to the chorus. After a few days of rehearsal, I realized that the girl who was cast in the lead as Mrs. Jingleby herself was not doing a very good job. I was very confident. I walked up to my teacher and said, "Yeah, I can do a better job than her." The teacher agreed. And in front of the entire kindergarten class and all their parents, I took my star turn wearing my quilted plaid jumper, a white blouse with a Peter Pan collar, and black Mary Janes. I might have had my hair cut short like a boy's, but I was an Eve Harrington right from the start. My mother, Renee, taught piano out of our house to make extra money. She's an excellent musician, but I never wanted to be one of her students. When we sat at the piano, she didn't nearly have as much patience with me as she did her other students. I used to swat her away so I could practice on my own. This would always lead to fights between us. Eventually, when I was still very young, I lost interest in piano altogether. It was one of my ways of rebelling. Instead of learning her instrument of choice, I would let her accompany me while I sang songs and did little dance routines for our friends and family. I would become dizzy on the applause, bowing vigorously for the very small crowd. From the time I was 3, before performing, I would shut myself in the closet at my grandmother's house. I wouldn't come out until I had been properly introduced. Then I'd walk into the room, hop up on the coffee table, and sing songs for the family. Mostly I did rhymes or things I heard on my favorite TV shows like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Sesame Street, or Romper Room. I would not allow Renee to accompany me on the piano. These were a cappella productions. I don't know where I was getting this from, but I always wanted to be a showgirl. I imagined costumes, big stages, colored lights, an announcer calling my name, and walking out there and putting on a show for the people. I wanted the full production, like an MGM musical with a moving staircase. Some people are dying to sing, and some people want to dance, but my goal was always to put on a show. One day when I was about 3, my mother and I went to visit her friend Anne. She lived in downtown Atlanta and would sometimes babysit me. Anne's neighbor, a woman who owned the Cheryl Neal & Associates talent agency, saw me playing by myself in the front yard. "Is this your little girl?" she asked Renee. I always called my mother Renee because I often saw her more as a peer. "Yes." "She is just really cute and entertaining as hell," she said. "I own a talent agency. I want you to bring her in and we can see what we can do for her." She gave my mother her card. Shortly thereafter, we went to her office and signed with her as my agent. She would send me out to castings for local commercials or TV shows that needed a cute, blonde little girl. This was not the Atlanta of today, where there are hundreds of shows being produced. Everything I was going out for was very small potatoes. Renee or my grandmother would drive me around to the auditions. As a small child, I always had a fun time, even if I didn't get the gig. I booked some of the jobs, but of course, I didn't get most of them. I remember doing some local commercials and a bit of modeling. Later in high school, I filmed a public service announcement in which I played a girl sitting on her bed, listening to her boombox. "I would love to be a rock star. I'd be famous," I said. "But some of them use drugs, and that scares me." That was my brain on cheesy PSAs. Any questions? When I worked, my mother would get the check, and she and my grandmother would put it into a savings account. Later, when I was a bit older, we would use the money I made to pay for my dance classes, singing lessons, and costumes. Even as a tiny tot, I was already putting my money right back into the business, a tactic I still employ. I loved going on auditions back then, because it was like putting on shows. Even when I was just at home, I was always bouncing around the house, pretending I was performing. Renee knew she needed to do something to get all of this energy and creativity out of me, so I wouldn't drive her crazy. She enrolled me in ballet and tap at the Art Link Letter Studio. I still remember my first tap number, which was to a song called Mississippi Mud. I wore a gold and black leotard with bows on it. My hat looked like a pie plate. The teacher told us that we had to spray silver paint on our tap shoes for our costume. I won the personality award at the recital. I don't know if I had a good or bad personality, but I sure had a lot of it. I loved being in dance class so much that Renee started putting me in children's theater. I joined both the Children's Civic Theater, which did seasonal theater productions, and the Atlanta Workshop Players, which would do monthly cabaret shows. Those were a combination of song, dance, variety, comedy, sketches, and everything else they could dream up for us kids. My grandmother was an excellent seamstress and would sometimes make my costumes for period pieces, and I still have some of them. The Children's Civic Theater would stage its shows at the Peachtree Theater, which is now a nightclub called Opera. These days, when I hit the club in Atlanta, I can see the spot where I stood on stage during all those productions. As I got a bit older, I started to take performing even more seriously. I took voice lessons, as well as dance classes. I changed to Fleetwood Studios and joined their travel team, which would compete against other studios. We weren't the best, we weren't the worst, but we were very dedicated. I had a friend named Kim who was in the Atlanta Workshop Players with me, and she danced at Fleetwood Studios as well. We would perform duets together in the company. Eventually, in high school, she left to go study ballet with some incredible Russian teacher, and our paths split. In the meantime, we would go to performance-based summer camp. We'd spend a week in a cabin in northern Georgia, out of the woods, working on a number or two. At the end of the week, everyone's parents would come pick them up, and we'd give a recital. It was kind of like Dirty Dancing, minus the dramatic lift in the final scenes. Yeah, there were no Patrick Swayzes here. At around 10, I was part of a pilot called The River Rats Club. It was a scripted kids show with songs and music. It was in the same vein as Kids Incorporated, the show where Fergie got her start. Our kids were a bit more country. We were hanging around with animals and stuff like that. We only made one episode, and it never went anywhere, but my mother still kept the folder from when I did it. She gave it to me recently along with a box of other mementos. It's 30 years later, but if they want to go to series, I still have the original script. Thanks, Renee, for sacrificing your basement all those years. A lot of little girls like to dance and perform, but for me it was slightly different. I didn't have brothers and sisters, and my mom was single for most of my childhood. My grandmother helped out a lot, but it was also important that I had somewhere to go. I think that's the biggest gift my family gave me. Through my mom's divorces and other tumultuousness of my childhood, I always had something to enjoy in my life, and that was performing arts. I met my friends through performing. I was also exposed to the LGBTQ community, people who were different from me. The thing about arts and being around creative people is that there is less discrimination over color, race, sexual orientation, or creed. It's just about talent. People only cared if you had it or not. If you were the best dancer, you got the part. It didn't matter what color your skin was or how much money your family had, or whether you were raised by a single mother. At my elementary school in Lilburn, Georgia, I would always perform in the talent show. In the fourth grade, I sang Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. I wore a purple satin jumper with silver sequins that my grandmother made for me. My blonde hair was swept back in Farrah Fawcett wings with a big lavender feather sticking out. It was somewhat redneck, but also totally adorable. This was the first of many manifestations of my love affair with Dolly Parton. By the time I entered sixth grade, Renee had appointed herself my creative director. She's always been what I would call a square. Her taste is much more toward the classics, and I was always oriented toward pop culture. I wanted to sing something that was on the radio, but Renee forced me to do My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music in my fifth grade talent show. My grandmother made me a beautifully smocked dress for the occasion, but even a good outfit can't save a boring number. When I was a child, my mother married my stepfather twice. The first time when I was 3, and the second time when I was 8. They divorced for the second and final time when I was 12. Soon before their second divorce, my mother and stepfather took a trip to Vegas. They saw a show at the Stardust called Le Lido de Paris, and I later found the program. I would eventually film my first video as Erica Jane on that same stage at the Stardust. It featured these beautiful women in glittering, barely there costumes and huge feather headdresses. Oh my God, I thought, this is what I want to be doing. I never wanted to sing like Julie Andrews, but I absolutely wanted to be out there with a big costume wowing the crowd. Although we lived in the conservative South, no one in my family ever blanched at stage nudity. I think it's because my mother and grandmother were both artists. They recognized these women were professionals plying a craft. Staying that fit and performing in those costumes every night was a difficult job. When I was in the 8th grade, I went to see Madonna's Virgin Tour when it came to Atlanta. That really changed my life. Because they had an extra ticket, I was able to go with my friend Kim from dance class and her older sister Julie. I thought, this woman is marrying elements of musical theater with pop music. Look at these cool costumes and these songs. That's when I realized this was my lane. I didn't want to do my favorite things. I wanted to be like Madonna. As much fun as I was having with the kids in dance class and community theater, I wasn't really loving life at the Catholic school my mother and stepfather sent me to. My classmates thought I was stuck up and arrogant because I would go off to do plays, commercials, and dance recitals. All the other kids were really into sports, and they didn't understand what I was into. We were 12 years old, so they made fun of anything that made me stand out from the pack, and they chose this. Of course I wanted to be accepted, but this is the age where kids begin pulling away from each other. You can start to see what kind of adults they're going to become. I realized that the kids at Catholic school would never be part of my tribe. Most of them were headed down a much more traditional path toward conventional careers. That never held any appeal for me, so I veered a different way. When it came time to attend high school, Renee and I moved out of my grandparents' house in Decatur, Georgia. We'd moved there when my stepfather left for the second and final time because it had broken my mother financially. Once she got her life back together, she bought a condo in Atlanta and we came roaring back to the city. This meant I could attend Northside High School, a public school that had a magnet program for performing arts. Thank God she had split from my stepfather. If she hadn't, I probably would have been forced to go to Catholic high school, which wouldn't have been good for me. To get into Northside's magnet program, I had to audition. I don't remember what song I sang, but it was good enough to get me into the musical theater department. I'm thankful for that. Just like every other high school kid, I had to take algebra, English literature, chemistry, biology, and the rest of it. But then, 2 hours of my day were spent working in the musical theater department. Some kids came for art, drama, dance, and other disciplines. The theater tech department, where I met my first boyfriend, Jonathan, created all the lighting and sets for our production. The school's orchestra would perform for our musicals. Starting my sophomore year, I was also in the school's tour show. Every year, we'd put on a revue and perform around the world. About 30 kids traveled, chaperoned by Mr. Dinsmore, the head of the musical theater department. He was in his 50s, tall, with a bald head surrounded by a horseshoe of gray curls. He looked exactly like how you'd imagine a high school music teacher. He was great at his job, taking the kids seriously and cultivating their talent. Mr. Dinsmore was always working to bring more visibility and cachet to our program. He was hard on me, but to be fair, he was hard on all of us. He certainly didn't have an easy job. Dealing with 30 unruly high school kids is hard enough, but add to it all of those creative kids with their egos and insecurities. Hopefully Mr. Dinsmore had a lifetime supply of Xanax to get him through those trips. Kids in the arts grow up fast. There's a certain level of maturity that comes from having to be responsible for being at rehearsal on time, learning all your lines, taking care of your costume, doing your own hair and makeup, not missing the call time, and doing a good job on stage. Anyone who didn't do all those things wouldn't last very long. Don't get me wrong, especially in the later years in Europe, we were sneaking out at night to hit up the clubs and drink. It was legal at 18 there, and we were all having a great time. We socialized like adults, trying to act more mature than we actually were. For all intents and purposes, we were adults. Adults with no bills, which is the best kind to be. Every spring break, all the arts kids would travel to a different city in Europe, while all of our schoolmates were being rednecks at Panama City Beach in Florida. We would go to different churches in Brussels, London, Paris, or Vienna. The orchestra would play, and all of the musical students would sing Latin Mass. Tour show would also play theater dates for the local audiences. We got to travel and see the world while working on our craft, which is far better than wasting our spring break sitting on the sofa watching The Price is Right. Each year, the tour show had a different theme. One year, it was a salute to Broadway. Another year, it was pop hits, things like that. We did both standards from the songbook and contemporary hits from the 80s. My junior year was a banner one because I got to reprise my role as Dolly Parton singing 9 to 5. That same year, I was also cast as Madonna and did Into the Groove. I wore black patent leather booties, black lace tights under a black skirt, and a black Betsy Johnson top that was shaped almost like an inverted triangle. I wore a black lace bow in my hair and, of course, black lace gloves. You can't do early Madonna realness without black lace gloves. I thought I was so cool, I was practically on that Virgin Tour. Most people in the show got a solo number, but it was a 90-minute performance with about 15 numbers. So when you weren't in the spotlight, you were singing and dancing back up for someone else or backstage getting into another costume for the next number. Everyone wanted to be in every number and to be out on that stage as much as possible. 30 years later, it's just like some of those Real Housewives fighting for camera time. Travis Payne, who would play a pivotal role later in my life, was one of my good friends in tour show. All of my friends at Northside High were in the arts program there. The normal kids in our algebra and economics classes weren't part of our circle. Occasionally, tour show would make additional trips abroad. When Atlanta was wooing the Olympic host committee to hold the summer games there, we flew to Tokyo to represent our city. Throughout the school year, we would perform all around the Atlanta region. Coca-Cola, which is headquartered in Atlanta, sponsored our school, so we got to do some really cool stuff thanks to that affiliation. In 1987, for the celebration of Atlanta's 150th birthday celebration, the company put on a huge performance at the Omni, which is now Philips Arena. It told the story of the brand through song and dance. Yeah, it sounds like a cheesy halftime show, but it was really spectacular. They laid out a lot of dough for this thing with sets, costumes, and lights. They also hired Michael Peters, who had choreographed Michael Jackson's iconic Thriller and Beat It videos to do the choreography. Peters brought in dancers from Los Angeles to be the featured performers, but they took the best from the dance and musical theater departments at Northside High to back them up. We'd all been in shows before, obviously, but this was the first time any of us were seeing a real production with a big bankroll behind it. At the time, working with Michael fucking Peters was just about the coolest thing a dance kid could imagine. In addition to having a tour show that performed at home and abroad, we would also regularly stage musicals locally. We performed them at the Woodruff Arts Center, a huge complex in Atlanta. I was a natural Val in a chorus line, and I still remember all the words from her signature song, Tits and Ass. It was very on brand for Erika Jayne, even before she existed. By the time my senior year rolled around, I was over high school theater. I had already decided I was moving to New York to start my career and had mentally checked out. There was a lot of internal politics about who got cast and what roles they would have, and I was tired of playing that particular game. One thing about me is when I've had it, I've had it. It's over. Mentally, I was planning for the next step in my life. I didn't audition for the spring musical, which that year was Pippin. Well, Mr. Densmore decided to call Renee. "Why hasn't Erika tried out for the spring musical?" he asked her. "Listen, Billy," Renee said, since they were on a first-name basis. "I can't force this girl. She decided she didn't want to audition, and she's not going to. My mother often called me unruly, but at the end of the day, she always had my back. The girl I cast in the role of Estrada isn't working out, and I'm going to cast Erika in the role instead," he said. "You know I can hold her diploma if she doesn't do this part for me." "I didn't know that, but I'll be sure to tell Erika," she replied. If musicals aren't your thing and you've never had a child in a musical theater program anywhere in the country because they all do Pippin, Fastrada is the wife of Pippin's father, King Charlemagne. She has a creepy, somewhat incestuous relationship with her son, Louis. Fastrada gets one solo at the end of the first act in a song called Spread a Little Sunshine. It's a cute waltz of a song, but the double entendres definitely hint that the sunshine she spreads beams out from between her legs. Even before I could legally vote, I was already being typecast as a temptress. Being cast against my will just made me mad. I hadn't even auditioned, and I was forced to take this part. That meant rehearsals and everything else that I didn't want to be doing. With Mr. Dinsmore and my mother both breathing down my neck, I decided I would give in. I'd worked hard for that diploma. If playing the sex pot in the most 70s musical imaginable was what it took to graduate, I would have to do it. Then, after pulling this stunt with my mother, Mr. Dinsmore wouldn't get rid of the original girl in the part. He made us split it. There were four performances. She got opening night and the third night. I got second night and the closing night. Since we had the same size feet, I even had to lend her my character shoes, which are the boxy high heels that every actress wears on Broadway. When I wasn't performing as Fastrada, I was in the chorus in the opening and closing numbers. I wasn't thrilled about any of this, but I was going along with it to keep the peace and graduate. During the cast meeting for our third performance, Mr. Dinsmore told the cast that the other girl would be playing Fastrada in the third performance as planned and on closing night, which was supposed to be my night. He was just using me to scare the girl he had cast in the first place to bring her A-game. I was his insurance policy. Now that he didn't need me, I was getting sidelined in a musical I didn't even want to be in. That was the final straw. I played it cool and waited until everyone was in costume. I even put on my own opening number costume, a gold lamé bandeau top and a gold lamé skirt slit up to my hip. I pretended like everything was fine. Right before the curtain went up, the lights dimmed in the theater. Everyone was taking their place on stage. But I turned, pushed the backstage door open, walked out, got in my car, and drove off, in costume, looking fabulous. I didn't perform that third night or come back for the fourth night. I'm sure my sudden departure screwed up the spacing in the chorus, and no one on stage was quite sure what to do when there was no one to deliver my scant few lines. Too bad. Mr. Dinsmore had already threatened to withhold my diploma and had gotten Renee all panicked, and now he's going to take my closing night? If he wouldn't hold up to his end of the bargain, why should I hold up to mine? Like I said, when I'm done, I'm done. You want to know the worst thing? That girl still has my shoes. Those specific shoes were rather expensive, and I had only worn them once. She never gave them back. It's been decades, and I'm still mad about the shoes. I did receive my diploma. That's all that really mattered to me. I also learned that I was never again going to let people hold power over me. I was so mad that I had to compromise for this man. I hated that he was in a position to hold something over my head. Mr. Dinsmore died years ago. He was important to my education and my career, and I still regret not talking it out as adults and making peace with him. I haven't been back to Northside since I graduated. As corny as it sounds, I still have dreams that take place in the musical theater room. I spent 4 years there, which seemed like an eternity at the time. It was a big U-shaped room with three-tiered elevated seating, so the chorus could sing on risers. Mr. Dinsmore played his grand piano in the center. In my dreams, I'm sitting in this room talking to my friends seated all around me. It's almost like I'm reliving rehearsals for shows. It sounds so crazy, but it's like I'm catching up with my friends as though we never left. As if we could get up and break out singing One from a chorus line in perfect unison and hitting every note and remembering every step. I'm 15 again, and we're all coming in and out and moving all around the room. I don't have that nightmare some people have where I'm performing and I haven't rehearsed. My dream is the rehearsal. That is where I'm at my happiest, working with the people I love and who can relate to me, getting ready to do my favorite thing in the whole world, which is putting on a show. Chapter 2, Classic Renee. My mother named me Erica after her favorite soap opera character, Erica Kane, on All My Children, played by Susan Lucci. When I was born, she was 18 and living in Atlanta, Georgia. She says that Erica Kane was everything that she wanted to be at the time, a smart, independent businesswoman and a brunette. My mother's name is Renee. My middle name, Nay, is based on Nene. Allegedly, that's what my father used to call my mother as a pet name for Renee. I never tell anyone my middle name because I hate it. It makes me sound so incredibly country. It also reminds me of my father. He married my mother when they found out she was pregnant, but then he left 9 months after I was born. He was never a part of my life. I always called my mom Renee because I felt like I was on a level playing field with her. It was never meant as a sign of disrespect not to call her mom, which I still did occasionally. It was a reflection of the way I viewed our relationship. It was like in a past life we were friends and somehow we ended up coming back as mother and daughter, and I wasn't going to call a peer mom. Just like my relationship with my middle name, my relationship with my mother has been complicated. She's been one of the closest people in my life, but no one can infuriate me the way she does. I think I came along at a very difficult time for my mother. She was a natural blonde with a perfect bombshell body. She was 18 and seeking magic. Instead, she ended up with a young child, a husband who took off, and a lot of difficulties. She dreamed of a future as a painter and a concert pianist. Despite being artistic enough to succeed at either, instead, she ended up as a bank teller who taught piano on the side. This was the South in the early 70s, which was still very conservative and not forward-thinking. After having a child and a failed marriage so young, she was just considered finished. Renee always had a level of anxiety, which was often related to bills. She worried about not having enough money for the both of us. She didn't have the kind of freedom or career she dreamed about when she was young. I bore the brunt of a lot of that stress. She was short with me, hard on me, and irritable. She would snatch my ponytail, dig her nails into my arm, and step on my feet. And that was in public. At home, she got me with the belt. She was never a lot of fun to be around. In short, she could be a real ass. The thing I heard her say more than anything else was, "I'm miserable." And it showed. I don't really remember my mother smiling or laughing a lot. I don't remember much joy there. She was disappointed and angry, and I think we would both agree that I got the brunt of it. Now that I'm older, I can recognize that I always had a high level of anxiety as a child. Because of my mother's situation, I never knew when the bottom might fall out. I took on the role of thinking, oh my God, are we going to get kicked out of this house because we can't afford it? What if she loses her job? What will we do then? It was just the two of us. I was a child and totally focused on her. If she was a wreck, it affected me too. I felt isolated with no one to turn to, play with, or talk to. It takes a toll in stressful times when you have no one to lean on. My grandparents were a stable influence, but we didn't live with them all the time. Imagine the anxiety of seeing the one and only person who can take care of you, upset and crying because you don't have enough money. Renee is also incredibly indecisive. "Well, I don't really know," she would drawl whenever I asked her what we were going to do. This would be about everything from major stuff like moving to New York to the minor things like what she wanted to do that weekend. She always seemed rudderless. To this day, ordering a meal with her drives me crazy. "Well, I don't really know whether to have the steak or the pasta," she'll tell the waiter. I just want to scream at her, "Just pick one, Renee. It's one meal. We'll have thousands more in our lifetime. Just make up your mind." She treated me like an adult when she really didn't have to. I think she expected me to understand or process certain situations in a more adult manner than I was able to, especially when it came to work and money. There's a fine line between keeping kids totally in the dark and telling them the adult truth. I don't think she got that balance right, and she erred on the side of telling me more than I could handle. Because she was under tremendous pressure, I think she collapsed slightly in on herself. She had a hard time finding her strength. It was almost like she needed me to get us both through the tough times. Being with that kind of mother made me grow up very fast. She always made me shake people's hands and look at them in the eye, even as a kid. I was expected to act and present myself like a mini adult rather than a young child. When I was small and working with a talent agency, she would make me call the agent and book all of my own appointments. That also meant I got to show up and pick up my own checks at the agency. Eventually, I was doing it all myself. Partially, it's because Renee didn't have time, but she also gave me the same work ethic she inherited from my grandparents. My mother was raised by Depression-era parents. They taught her and me that the world is difficult and often disappointing. We were told that life is hard. It's always going to be difficult, but if you work hard enough, you could have something, but probably not, so don't get too disappointed. It was almost as if they were instilling in us the sense to stay in our place. We could dream, but not too much. I was motivated as a child, but not by positive circumstances. I wasn't aspiring to do good things as much as I was trying to avoid negative consequences of not doing something. When I was little, my grandparents owned a lake house not far from where we lived. They had a powerboat that we would take out for water skiing. I loved being in the water, and I was athletic as a kid. But when I was learning, I had a hard time getting out of the water and up on the skis. My mother was frustrated that I wasn't getting it. Finally, she told me I had to get up on my skis because there was a water moccasin in the lake. Right quick, I figured out how to get up on those skis. That little fib did the trick. But from then on, I was always worried that the lake was full of snakes. My grandfather Hollis was the best speedboat driver. He'd have some shots of wild turkey and a few beers. Then he'd just whip me around that lake. Eventually, I got so good, I would put on my ski and jump directly from the dock. I would never even have to get in the lake. Because, you know, snakes. Renee's influence on my performing career was equally complicated. On the one hand, she always made sure we had enough money for dance lessons, costumes, and anything else I might need for children's theater productions I was in. She made sure that I got rides to and from all those things, and that I had all the tools necessary to succeed. I will always be grateful that she taught me that I could do anything I wanted to do. On the other hand, she could be incredibly cruel. In middle school, I was in dress rehearsal for a production of The Wiz, or maybe it was The Wizard of Oz, but had songs in it. I don't remember, but I do remember standing at the front of the stage in my costume, in a light blue jumper. I was going over my solo for the show. Renee was sitting in the audience. This particular song sat in the break of my voice, the middle register where I have a hard time singing. It was challenging to seamlessly blend a heavier chest tone into a lighter, airier head tone. When I was getting to the high note, I switched into falsetto voice to hit the note, and I heard Renee's laugh echoing around the room. I stopped singing immediately. Yes, it was a struggle, but I had hit the note. Instead of trying to help me or be encouraging, Renee often laughed at me. There was always a dagger in her comments about the performance I gave. She would say, "That could have been better," or "I didn't like that." She'd rip me to shreds all the time. But this was the first time that she ever did it in front of other people. To this day, whenever I'm on stage or in the recording booth, I'm constantly paranoid about being on key. I'm always visualizing the constant criticism from Renee. That's what was so odd about her. She would enable me to perform in this show, but then she would tear me down as I did it. She would never miss a performance, but if I did something she didn't like, she'd say, "That's stupid. Why'd you do that?" It was a total mindfuck. When I was in the musical theater department at Northside High School, we were doing a talent showcase where students could select any number they wanted. It was like the sort of talent shows other high schools would have, which was unusual for us because we were accustomed to more structured performances. Renee got wind of this performance and put her 2 cents in, acting as my creative director one more time. She was convinced I should perform a song from The Phantom of the Opera. "I shouldn't do that song for 2 reasons," I explained. "First, there's a really high part that's not fit for my voice. Second, it's not going to be that kind of night. I think I need to do something with a much more pop feel." I knew I was going to get buried because the other students were going to do cool stuff. Nothing as corny and stiff as The Phantom of the Opera. Renee was relentless. She badgered me until I finally gave up and sang the piece that she selected just to keep her happy. The night of the show, she came with a girlfriend. From the stage, I could see exactly where she was sitting in the audience. I got on stage wearing silver lamé pants and a matching top with big shoulder pads and my hair to one side. I was trying to add a little sparkle to this number. As I predicted, I gave a very average performance of the song. The response from the crowd was tepid at best. I could see my mother and her friend making faces while I tried to get through a number I didn't even want to do. I walked off stage where my classmate Mildred, who sang "And I'm Telling You I'm Not Going" in that year's tour show production, was sitting on some sound equipment with her feet dangling over the edge. As I walked by, she shook her head and said, "Man, that was fucked up." "Yeah, I know. Thanks," I said. After the show, I pointed out to my mother that my number hadn't gone very well. "Yeah," she said, "while you were singing it, I was sliding down in my seat." My mother was so young when she had me, and my grandmother, her mother, was such a maternal figure in my life that Renee and I could behave more like competitive sisters than mother and daughter. My junior year in high school, I had a solo in Northside's tour show. I sang 9 to 5 and dressed like Dolly Parton. That Halloween, I went ice skating at an indoor rink with my boyfriend and his family. I took a freak fall and slammed the back of my head on the ice and passed out. My boyfriend's father was a doctor at Piedmont Hospital, and he was worried I might have a concussion. They put me in the back of their van and drove me to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, someone called my mother. I was having a hard time staying awake. I was really out of it. When they asked me to touch my nose with my right hand, I touched my left ear. I got out of the MRI, and my mother was there. She was wearing my Dolly Parton costume from the tour show. She had on the big platinum wig, the denim shirt that ties in the front, the skin-tight jeans, cowboy boots, everything, including my fake Dolly Parton triple Ds. I was lying there with the neurologist when she walked in with her friend Cheryl, who was dressed as Reba McEntire. I slurred, "Are you wearing my Dolly Parton costume?" "Yes," Renee said. "We went out to the club for Halloween and I needed a costume." I was so embarrassed. Here I was with a head injury bad enough to keep me in the hospital for several days, and my mother showed up in my costume with her best friend looking like they were going on stage at the Grand Ole Opry. The neurologist was checking my brain functions, and he told me to count down from 100, subtracting 7 each time. I said, 93, and blanked on the next number. "What's 7 from that?" the doctor asked. "Shit, she can't do that when she's normal," Renee said. "She's not good in math." I started to wish she hadn't come to the hospital at all. Just like almost every teenage girl and her mother, we used to fight. With Renee, things could get really bad. She would sometimes say the most hateful things to me. Once, in the middle of a fight, probably over something stupid, it got so heated she said to me, "I wish I never had you." That stung so badly, in part because I knew it was true. People can feel when they're unwanted. I know Renee loved me, but I knew she would have been okay without me. She probably would have preferred to follow her dreams rather than having to raise me. I definitely picked up Renee's talent for saying hateful things, and I would use it against her. That's why I'm always so afraid to lose my temper on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. If I ever did, I'm afraid I'd really eviscerate someone. I would cuss her out every now and again, but I was basically a good kid. I played by the rules, took care of myself, and did not get into trouble. But I didn't have a lot of respect for my mother. That's not to say everything was horrible. And I know there are people who had it worse. She wasn't a drug addict. She never beat me or neglected me. But there was a sense of stability and guidance I wanted from my mother that I never got. I had to develop it on my own. I have to hand it to her, though. When I needed it, Renee always had my back. There would be moments when she would be so clutch. One example is the summer before my senior year. Because I was in the musical theater program at Northside High School, there wasn't time for me to take my economics and health classes during the school year. I had to make them up at summer school. Instead of being at Northside, these classes were at Harper High School. One day after class, I found a note on the windshield of my car. "You don't belong here," it read. "If you keep coming here, we're going to beat the shit out of you." I got home and showed the note to Renee. I was a little concerned about my safety, but mostly I was worried whether I'd be able to finish summer school. I needed those credits to graduate on time. The next day, Renee marched down to the school. She barged into the principal's office and demanded a meeting with him. She showed him the note and said, "What are you going to do about this?" I'm not going to have my daughter feel unsafe at your school. I don't know if it was Renee's presence or tone or what, but after that, I never had any trouble. The situation got handled. When I was in middle school, we lived in a two-story house in Lilburn, Georgia. On weekend mornings, Renee would play classical music at the upright piano in our living room. It was usually reserved for her piano students, but sometimes she'd make an exception. She'd play for hours, the notes drifting up to my room as I would lie in bed and listen. I was scared that if I got up, the music might stop. At my house now, we have a Steinway grand piano. When Renee comes to visit, I love it when she plays for me. It reminds me of all those mornings when things seemed peaceful and beautiful, even if just for a short time. I think when I went to Los Angeles at 25 and moved away from her completely, it was the best thing that ever happened to us. I needed to be my own woman. I think she needed to be her own, too, to focus on herself and not have to worry about me. Now I can finally have a good time with my mother. She's a lot more fun when she's not stressed out about money and raising a kid. We actually have a fair amount in common. We're both artistic and creative, very ambitious, and we both know how to work hard. Renee is much happier with her life now than when I was younger. After working as a bank teller when I was very small, she continued working in the mortgage industry. She was good at it and made great money, but it was never her passion. In 2008, the mortgage industry blew up. I told her, "This is the best thing that's ever happened to you. Now you can do what you really want to do." She went back to school at Georgia State and got her bachelor's degree in fine arts. The moment she got on that path, she became a much freer, nicer person. When her parents got sick, my grandfather with cancer and my grandmother with Alzheimer's, she moved into their house to take care of them. She would have to commute to downtown Atlanta every day for school, but still managed to make the dean's list. It was a hard time for her, but like I said, no one is finer in the clutch than Renee. When she was in school, I would send her on a painting trip each summer so she could have a break from school and her parents. She had really earned some time alone. When my grandparents died, she stayed in their house. Recently, she decided to put the house on the market. "When this goes, that's the last of my parents," she told me. "But this house was their dream," I told her. "It was never your dream. It was their life. You're in your 60s. You should go have your own life. You need to do what makes you happy. You need to go where you need to be." "That's true," she said. "So what do you want to do now?" I asked. She said, "Well, I don't really know." Classic Renee. Chapter 3, Father Figures. One of my very first memories is from my third birthday party. I was at my maternal grandparents' house, and my grandmother, Anne, was holding me in her arms. "Oh, look," she said in an excited, high-pitched tone. "There's your grandfather." "Who?" I asked. I did not understand that I had another grandfather other than her husband, my grandfather Hollis, in whose house I was living at the time. She meant my father's father. I had never met my other grandfather before. But then again, I had never met my father either. I was looking out of the large plate glass windows that overlooked her beautiful garden in the backyard. My birthday is in July, so the garden was lush in the summer sun. The memory is just a blurry flash. I don't even remember meeting him, just being told that my grandfather was present. I'm told that my paternal grandfather was a very tall man and that he gave me a little carousel as a gift that day. My mother said that I loved it, and for a while it was my favorite toy. That was the only time he visited. He and my grandmother Anne were in contact, and that's how she invited him to come to my birthday party. When I was older, she told me that she used to mail him pictures of me. She hoped he would pass them on to my father, but instead he would just return them. Eventually, when I was in middle school, he sent her a note asking her to stop sending pictures altogether. My paternal grandfather grew up in northern Georgia and joined the military where, according to family legend, he served as Dwight Eisenhower's personal assistant. When in Miami, he met Esther, a small Mayan woman. She'd inherited a coffee plantation in El Salvador called Esperanza after her first husband died. My grandfather married her and moved to El Salvador, where he helped expand the plantation and raise the children from her first marriage. They had three sons together, my father, Nicholas, being the oldest. The way the story was told to me, the communists were rampaging through their country and seized my grandmother's plantation. In the middle of the night, my grandfather got his three boys and ran through the jungle to get them on a plane going back to the United States. He left my grandmother there with her three older children. He had been in the military, so he knew things were only going to get worse, and he only took care of himself and his sons. The four of them resettled back in Atlanta when my father was 15, his brother Gabriel was 14, and the youngest, Alejandro, was 3. They moved into a house on Don Juan Lane in Decatur, Georgia. I'm not kidding. I can't make this shit up. It was like they moved to Latin Lover Lane. I only met my paternal grandmother, Esther, once, even though she sent me Christmas cards in Spanish for years. She wore a floor-length chinchilla coat and carried a cigarette holder. She was known to get her hair and makeup done every day. She was very grand, and she came to my grandmother Anne's house and gave me one of those dolls that pees when you feed it a baby bottle and whose diaper you can change. She didn't speak English, but she told me the doll's name was Lolita. After he took off with their children in the middle of the night, Esther never got back together with my grandfather. I don't think she ever forgave him for taking her children away, especially Alejandro, being only 3. These kids, now teenagers, who'd grown up in El Salvador, were wild. My grandfather, a former military man, couldn't handle living in a house with 3 messy, unruly boys. He built them a shed behind the house where they could live and run wild. He let Alejandro live inside the house, though. All 3 boys spoke Spanish and English with perfect accents. They were all devastatingly handsome and had that Latin bad boy air of not giving a shit. My father and his brother Gabriel carried sawed-off shotguns in their cars and weren't afraid to let everyone know it. This attitude made them absolutely irresistible to all the girls in their high school. My mom sure found it sexy. Renee was friendly with my father's younger brother, Gabriel. He invited her to go to a party with him, even though he had just broken up with his girlfriend. Renee insists that it wasn't a date. At that party, he introduced her to the man who would become my father, and the two of them started dancing together. "When are you going to ask me out?" Renee said, and he did so on the spot. It's funny because years later, when I was working as a cocktail waitress at Chasen's, I used a similar trick to get Tom Girardi, my future husband, to ask me out. They dated a few months and fell in love. When Renee became pregnant, they got married. It only lasted 18 months, and Nicholas divorced my mother when I was 9 months old. Everyone in the family always liked my dad and said nice things about him. But I think 2 things were happening here. Number 1, my mother was 18 years old, and he was 23. They were both young, and there is a lot of drama and immaturity that goes along with that. Number 2, I think my grandmother, Anne, was probably really overbearing and tried to control everything because that's who she was. My mother and father lived right next door to her, so they never had the chance to be grown-ups on their own. That couldn't have been easy for them. Just recently, my mother told me that after she and my father separated, she moved back in with her parents. One day, my father called up and asked to take her out. My grandparents babysat me, while my parents went to the drive-in in the black Dodge Charger he bought brand new when I was born. On their date, my father said to Renee, "Tomorrow I'm going to come by your parents' house, pick you up, and we're going to go hunt for apartments. The 3 of us will live together and be a little family." It was really romantic at the drive-in, so this was all fabulous. He dropped my mother off at my grandparents' house. The next day, my mother waited and waited. He never came. He never called. Finally, she called her friend Janet, who had recently married Nicholas's brother Gabriel. She asked if Janet had seen my father. "Oh, no, honey, he's moved to California. He left this morning," Janet said. When she told me the story, my mother said, "Erica, he had it all planned out. As we were making out in the car at the drive-in, I was wondering why all his clothes were hanging on a rod in the back seat." I don't think my father wanted to be a dad. He was a mechanic at a car dealership in town at the time, and he wanted a different life for himself. Once he moved to California, my father wasn't a part of my life at all. I vaguely remember him coming by my grandmother's house to see me one time when I was very young. But it's more like I recall his presence rather than actually seeing him or spending time with him. That's it. But that doesn't mean his family wasn't around. My mother was very close with my Aunt Jenna and still is to this day. She even went as Erica Jane one year for Halloween. I remember when I was very small before kindergarten, going over a couple of times to the house she shared with my uncle. Jenna eventually divorced my uncle for what my mother considered more than sufficient cause. He moved in with his brother Alejandro in an apartment complex. Janet moved to an apartment and started a new job as a beautician when she left my uncle. She drove a silver Corvette that she absolutely loved. A week after she moved, she came out of her apartment to go to work but couldn't see her car anywhere in the parking lot. What did she see in her parking space? A big black hearse with a manila envelope taped to the windshield with the word Janet printed on it. My uncle had taken her car and left a hearse in its place. She had just started this job, so she couldn't be late for work. She decided to drive the hearse and deal with it later. The worst part was when she got in and started the car with the keys that were in the ignition, it only went in reverse. She was totally stranded. To this day, no one has figured out how my uncle had gotten this busted-ass car there in the first place. The whole situation between her and my uncle, between my mom and my dad, was just a Southern-style shambles. After my father left, Renee never really dated. I mean, if she did, she did it on the low. She never had anyone over at the house spending the night. My mother was very conscientious about that. She didn't have boyfriends. She didn't try to pawn me off on someone else. She wasn't that mom. When I was 3, she married my stepfather, John. My mother tells me that I was at the wedding, but I have zero recollection of that, probably because I knew their relationship was bullshit even at 3 years old. From the beginning, the strain between them was obvious. I had enough of a feel for my mother to know this would never last. My first memory of them as a couple is when they were off at Disneyland on their honeymoon. My grandmother watched me because we were living with her then. I was sitting on my grandmother's white leather couch when she came over and said to me, "Now that your mom got married, you're not going to be living here anymore." My mom came back from vacation and we all moved into an apartment near my grandmother's house. Soon they bought a cute little ranch house in Stone Mountain, Georgia. We had a big backyard and it was very middle class. My stepfather was handsome and tall, maybe 6'2". He was from Pittsburgh, from a nice family of Polish immigrants. Sometimes we would go to Pittsburgh, just the two of us, and we'd go ice skating and sledding and do the things we couldn't do down south. He was always very loving and kind toward me. We played sports and bonded over baseball and cars. He was in the car business and dragged me around everywhere with him, even the auto auction. Later on, he owned a used car lot, so he and Renee were always getting new cars and swapping out the old ones to sell. I knew all about cars, and I would always beg him to bring home the fastest one on the lot. He's the one who really started my lifelong love of fast cars. I've always been afraid of the dark, so it was very hard for me to sleep as a child. I would try to sneak into my parents' bed, and my mom would get mad. But my stepfather used to let me sneak in on his side and sleep next to him. As sweet as he was with me, he and my mother had a rocky relationship. There was a lot of fighting and volatility. They were both under 30, trying to hold down jobs and raising a young daughter. Then my mother found out there was another woman in my stepfather's life, and that was the end of their relationship. Renee was working as a bank teller, as well as teaching piano. One weekend, she went away on a painting trip to Edisto Beach, South Carolina. The weekend was a bit weird because my stepfather was sleeping in the guest room. As usual, I fell asleep in my little bed and then went to crawl in with him in the middle of the night when I got scared of the dark. I remember lying in bed with him thinking, "Why are we here? This is so strange. I don't have any connection to this room at all." Suddenly, I started to get mad at him, like I could intuit that something bad was going on between him and Renee. I was 5, looking over at the bathroom thinking, "I don't want to get up. I don't feel comfortable. So I'm just going to pee in this bed." That's what I did. I have never wet the bed before or since, but that one time I was a bed wetter out of spite. "Oh my God, Erica, what's wrong?" he asked, startled as he jumped out of bed. "Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry. I just couldn't make it," I told him. But I was peeing on him on purpose. It's almost as if I knew what was coming, like, "Fuck you." The next day, Renee returned from her trip and my stepfather packed his car and left. That was the reason we were sleeping in the guest room, because he had been packing up all of his things in their bedroom. At the time, I didn't know the details of what went wrong with his and Renee's relationship, just that she had returned from her trip, and the next day, my stepfather packed up and left us. At the time, you could get a no-fault divorce in Georgia in 30 days, and a month later, the papers were signed. It was all over. For the next year, there were no men in my mother's life. Then one day, she said to me, "He's moving back in." She met my stepfather. Unbeknownst to me, the two of them had been talking on the phone regularly the entire year. They had reconciled while he was living back near his family in Pittsburgh. They decided to get married for a second time. I still remember staring out the window of our ranch house, seeing his car pull up and vibrating with excitement, thinking, "Oh my God, my stepfather's back. He's back." The one thing about John is he was always great in business, very motivated. The one consistent thing in my life is that everyone around me has always been a hard worker. This includes both of my husbands, my stepfather, my father, my mother, my grandparents, and my son. After a few years, we upgraded and bought a bigger house in Lilburn, Georgia. It was a big two-story home. I transferred to Lilburn Elementary School and for the first and only time in my life brought home straight A's. Renee was working with my stepfather, helping him run the car lot. It was just like how my grandmother had helped my grandfather run his plumbing company. For a while, things were very good between Renee and my stepfather. My mother went so far as to apply for an annulment for her first marriage to my father, so that she and my stepfather could get their union recognized by the Catholic Church. When I was 10, Renee pushed to have my stepfather legally adopt me. By that time, I think my stepfather considered me his child. I think he really did love me. This adoption push came in the summertime. I was upstairs in the house, and my mother was sitting on her bed talking on the phone. "Your father wants to talk to you," she told me, holding out the receiver. "Huh, what?" I thought, a bit confused to speak to this man I'd only heard about until now. "Okay." I got on the phone with him, and he asked if I wanted my stepfather to adopt me. The whole thing was confusing to me because I was just a kid. I knew this man on the phone was my real dad. I knew that my stepfather was doing this thing called adoption. But at age 10, I wasn't sure what all that meant. I just wanted to go to ballet class and be done with it. "Is this something you want to do?" my father asked. "Yeah," I said automatically. I didn't know what I wanted, but Renee really wanted it, and I wanted to make her happy. Apparently, that was enough for my father. He relinquished his parental rights so my stepfather could legally adopt me. That summer, the process was completed, and I got a brand new birth certificate with my stepfather's last name as my name. We had a few great years together, with Renee and my stepfather getting along and business thriving. But then the fighting resumed when Renee discovered that he'd been unfaithful again. One day, when I was in middle school, it all blew up. He left us for the second and what would be the final time on Thanksgiving. That year, none of us had much to be thankful for. By that point in their relationship, I was done with both of them. To be honest, I've been done with these people since I was basically walking and talking. I thought, this is dumb. The whole thing is dumb. This is not going to work out. It's crazy how instinctually right I was about their relationship. If I could see it as a kid that it wasn't going to work out, why the hell couldn't they see it? While they were fighting and cussing each other out, I didn't blame myself as some kids do. I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. I knew that everything was wrong with them. There are two things I knew since the day I was born. I was fine, and my grandmother and I were the only two sane motherfuckers out of all these crazy people. The day that my stepfather left was hard, though. Renee sat in a chair in the living room, wearing a pair of navy shorts and a purple polo shirt. She was sobbing into her hands. Her face was pressed into the side of the chair. I thought, and I will never forget this. I don't ever want to be like that. I love my mother, but in that moment, I saw her as weak. I knew that she could survive without a man, but she wanted a partner so badly that she let him ruin her life. We'd had a great house. We'd had Christmas trees and parties and a yard and a dog named Cubby. It was all great. Now it was all gone. Renee and I were still living in that big two-story house. but since she'd been working for his business, he was the one making all the money. When he left, he cleaned out their checking account and left Renee with nothing. The next month, Renee did